Tabler Online presents Pottercast, Dwarfcast Episode 4. This week we'll be discussing Blast and Scroots. Best served with fire whiskey or pumpkin juice?
Pumpkin juice.
Also, special Muggle Report, French Fries, Not Really From France, by Fleur Weasley.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce Doug Zeitlin, executive producer of Harry Potter lookalike contests in South Africa.
I'd like to introduce special correspondent Ken Halloran. Ken is keeper of the Holy Chastity Belt of Nee and winner of the Strongbow Cup of Kvetch. And finally, our regular correspondent, Jim Caswell, executive producer of Green Party Functions, Yellow Ice Warnings, and Blue Balls.
Today's format is going to be just a little bit different. As opposed to going into any great depths of history and things of that nature, we're going to...
Assume you've actually been paying attention to popular culture for the past decade.
We're going to dive directly in and talk about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. In case you missed it on the front page of our website, this is a spoiler episode. If you don't want to know what happens in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows...
Turn us off now.
We're going to do this in a roundtable format. We're just going to ask questions and listen to the answers. Well, gentlemen, let's just start at the beginning. What is your overall opinion of the seventh book as a conclusion to the Harry Potter series?
I liked it.
It was a very enjoyable book. There were still a few questions that were left unanswered, but overall, I think she hit on about 80% of the questions that the audience still had.
To use our standard format, I give it 5 pens in the pocket protector, which is to say I liked it very much since the pocket protector only holds 4 pens. I think the book served as a fitting conclusion to the Harry Potter story, and yet still left many unanswered questions in terms specifically of the universe that she has created.
Yeah, but I think that is just the fact that the books are Harry's story, not the universe's story, which I think is something people lose sight of in this day and age when so many places the universe is the story.
She did a wonderful job of painting this humongous tapestry, and the background of the tapestry doesn't have to be filled in all the way in order for the lead characters to pop out at you. In fact, in some ways, when the background is a little bit blurred, it makes the images in the foreground pop that much more.
I think it's pretty clear that the title of every single book is Harry Potter and. These stories are about Harry Potter. For his story, she certainly did leave a little bit of a blurry background to bring him into focus. I think there are other questions, completely unrelated to Harry Potter, that can still be answered in a justifiable format.
If she decides that she needs even more money, she can always come back and fill in some of those details.
I think that's just a rather cynical answer. I think that there's more out there that the fans want. There's more out there that's a legitimate story.
The thing is, though, is that she could write books set within this universe, one a year for the rest of her lifetime and her children's lifetimes, and the fans probably still wouldn't get enough.
That's not necessarily a bad thing. Doctor Who's been on the air in one format or another for over 40 years. Star Trek for nearly 40 years. Superman's been in the comics since the 1930s. A story doesn't have to be completed in 7 volumes.
But none of those formats have had the exact same people doing it for the entire length of time. Superman's had different writers, there have been 10 different Doctor Who's, there have been 5 different crews in Star Trek. To expect her to dedicate the rest of her life to creating more books within this series, I think is a bit selfish on the part of fans.
I think that you're making your point for them. There have been 5 different series in Star Trek. There have been 10 different actors playing Doctor Who. Perhaps we need to do a 3-volume set, Albus Dumbledore and the Deadly Hallows, or Godric Gryffindor and the Creation of Hogwarts. There is a lot of different area that hasn't been expressed yet.
If she was willing and able to allow other people to play in this playground that she's created, possibly. My point is that it's selfish on the part of readers to expect her to dedicate the rest of her life to...
pleasing them.
Exactly.
That's what authors do. Janet Ivanovich has written 13 volumes in the Stephanie Plum series. Sue Grafton has written nearly 24 in her mystery series. That's what authors do. They pick their genre and they write in it.
Yes, but the thing is she doesn't have to. On a functional level, Joanne Rowling can retire. She has no incentive.
Other than the joy of writing.
That's exactly it. Writers write. Now, I'm not saying she has to only ever do Harry Potter, or only ever do Hogwarts, but there's no reason why she can't continue in this universe.
Unless she doesn't want to anymore.
Maybe she does. I think that the books have made it clear the story of Harry Potter is over. Does she want to tell a story about Albus Potter? I doubt it, but maybe that's why she did 19 years later.
She left her options open. It is simply that. If she wants to write more, she can. She's not obligated.
I think we can all agree that she has all of her options open to her. If she wants to retire, she can retire. If she wants to write more Hogwarts stories, she can do that too. If she wants to go on out and create something new, she has that option. She's in a very nice position where anything that she wants to do, she can do. She could create something brand new in a completely different genre, and you know it's still going to sell millions of copies.
Let's call this question number two. Can J.K. Rowling follow up Harry Potter with anything?
I hope she can, and I'd like to see her try, because I think she is a good enough writer that I wouldn't want her to be a one-trick pony. Admittedly, that one pony brought in billions of dollars, but it's a one-trick pony nonetheless.
Pretty much, we know her next book will sell, just simply riding the wave. The question is, will her second next book sell?
To put that stipulation on it, that in order for her to be successful, she has to duplicate this, I think is unfair. And no, I don't think she can.
The odds of catching lightning in a bottle a second time, this kind of phenomenon in the field of literature has never happened before.
I'd go so far as to say this type of phenomenon in any media cannot be duplicated, whether it is television or movies or radio. Star Wars is universally accepted as one of the creators of the blockbuster movie. Star Wars The Phantom Menace is considered one of the worst science fiction movies ever made. Ed Wood quality, almost. Honestly, no matter what she does, people aren't going to like it. Even if she picks Dumbledore or Gryffindor or Ravenclaw, people are going to go, it's not Harry Potter.
I think the goal that I would personally like to see her set would be to create something new and show that she is capable of doing something beyond Harry Potter.
But let's take some time to actually talk about this book, not what the next book is going to be.
Right.
Okay.
This was a pretty bloody, violent book. Was the death count too high?
Considering that most of the story revolved around a war taking place, I was actually kind of surprised that the quote-unquote on-screen deaths were as few as they were. That being said, she did cut a pretty bloody swath through a majority of her characters.
I don't know. I think there is a point of saying that she wasn't trying to soft sell. In war, people die. Period.
She kind of pulled a fast one, I think, on the publishing company. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone was a kid's story. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows was a literature story. I wouldn't necessarily call it Shakespearean, but it was certainly a story that was meant to be told for multiple generations.
Oh, it definitely had some Shakespearean quality to it. As we said, it had a very high death toll.
Not all of Shakespeare's stories had high death tolls, only the tragedies and some of the history.
One of the qualities that I always admired about these books, though, is that she wrote at the age level of Harry in that book. When she wrote book one, she wrote it for a 11-year-old to read. By the time she got around to Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, she's writing to 17 years and above. It isn't the same age bracket that she's writing to. She's done an excellent job of determining what reading level to write at for each book.
Honestly, I think you give her too much credit. I think when she wrote Philosopher's Stone that she was a pretty crummy writer. She learned to write as the books were being published, so that Chamber of Secrets is better than Philosopher's Stone, and Deathly Hallow is the best written book of the bunch.
I prefer to give her too much credit.
Well, continue on with the theme. Which death in the book had the most impact on you?
From my point of view, the most tragic death was that of Lupin and Tonks. Number one is the fact that it took place away from Harry's point of view. It comes as a surprise both to Harry and to the reader. They are part of the death toll. And through the process of the book, we learn about the birth of Teddy. It dawns on us that with both of them dead in this war, we have yet another orphan. And much like Harry was in the last war, this child is going to be on their own.
War makes orphans. It goes back to the fact that she's not soft-selling what war is.
The death that had the most impact on me was Dobby, because that was on screen from Harry Potter's point of view, and you got to feel his thoughts and his feelings and see just how devastating that was to him. And I don't think any of the rest of the deaths were less devastating to him, especially Hedwig.
Dobby's was the only death that actually made me cry.
That's exactly my thoughts. I read the spoilers. I knew Dobby was going to die, and I still cried when he died.
I give you that that was a very powerful one. Lupin and Tonks were the only ones where, when it happened, I had to close the book, and I was just sitting there going, no, I had trouble accepting it. Dobby dying, I understood why it happened from a storytelling point of view. Lupin and Tonks hit me in a different way.
So we all agree that this book held no punches. You could argue that it may have been extraneous. Do you feel that there was any deaths that really did not impact the story?
Fred's. It just seemed like the, okay, yes, there has to be a death in the Weasley clan. Somebody has to die.
Yeah, why bring Percy back and not kill him?
Mr. Tonks' death had very little impact because we knew so little about him. He wasn't a character that we had become attached to.
I agree. He seems to have been written in as a throwaway character. For me, for 99% of the book, Hedwig's death bothered me, not upset me. It was a throwaway. Somebody had to die in the opening scene.
Actually, I think it was a story mechanic death. Having them have to care for the owl or figure out where to leave the owl while they're out looking or what have you.
Or having people follow the owl back to where they were.
To simplify the plot, Hedwig had to die. It's not a good death. If it was reality, it would be even more bothersome, but it was a story function death. That said, you said 99%.
Yes. In the final pages of the book, when we find the body of Colin Creevy, it came out of nowhere. It was not important.
He's just another death toll.
Exactly. He's more of a character than Ted Tonks. We've known Colin for years now, but it was just like, okay, who's another character who we could kill that nobody would really care about?
Actually, I think there were people out there in fandom who want him to die, which is just sad, really, but I think there were people who were annoyed with him.
He was written to be an annoying character. He was the Jar Jar Binks of this universe. But Ken brought up a good point about redemption. Redemption is a running theme throughout all of the books. So, after 7 books, who was redeemed?
Snape was the obvious choice.
He's the obvious choice, but I don't really feel as though his redemption was that meaningful, just because most of what he did out of selfish reasons.
Truth of the matter is, he wasn't redeemed in as much as he wasn't as evil as we were made out to see, going back to the whole the book is from Harry's point of view. Snape was never that evil, number one. And number two, no, he never did fully get over the fact that he had an irrational hatred of Harry for the simple fact that Harry is the son of James Potter.
I disagree with that because of one line in the book. Page 687 of the American edition. Third paragraph from the bottom. This is Dumbledore. Have you grown to care for this boy after all? Snape produces his Patronum, which is a doe. Always, said Snape. He has always seen Harry Potter as Lily's son. He has always wanted to protect him. He has always been the one link that Severus has left to his one true love. Yes, he hated James Potter. James Potter was his romantic better, his better in social activities, his better at magic. And the arrogance that James Potter had, Severus wanted to beat out of Harry Potter, but Severus always loved Harry Potter.
Love and hate go hand in hand, usually. You can only hate someone you've cared about.
There were actually 2 characters that I felt were redeemed more than Snape, just because there was such a wide swing in their personalities. The first would be Creature. As Sirius Black's house elf, he did pretty much everything within his power to fight against Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. It isn't until Hermione steps in and teaches Harry that they need to treat Creature well that Creature turns around and becomes not only a better person, but one of the most loyal characters to Harry outside of his core group of people. It's Creature who is leading the house elves into battle. It's him that has essentially gone from being enemy to ally.
It's an underlying theme throughout the book that the wizarding community's mistreatment of the other magical creatures is wrong. That's something that becomes more and more clear throughout the book.
Throughout all of the books.
And the rolling surrogate in the story, Hermione Granger, is the one who jumps on the bandwagon immediately and starts spew. You're absolutely right about what happened with Creature, and there's a function to it. Among those who were redeemed, the Malfoys.
See, again, I don't really see where the Malfoys were overly redeemed, because all the way through it, they were just looking out for number one. They didn't want to be on Voldemort's bad side, so they continued to work with him. Narcissa only spares Harry's life at the end because she doesn't want the fighting to continue because she wants to get her boy out of there. It's not to save Harry's life. If Harry had been forced to tell her, no, Draco's dead, she would have turned him in a second. It was purely a selfish motivation.
They never became friends, but there's at least some grudging acceptance of Harry and friends Actually, it was Ron who specifically saved Malfoy twice. And the implication is that they were never close, but...
I think that Draco learned his lesson. Whether or not he was redeemed, I suppose, is still a matter that can be argued. However, in 19 years later, he is not an arrogant, stuck-up bastard to them. He's not nice to them, he's not their friends, but he's accepting of them.
The other character that I saw as being truly redeemed was that of Dudley Dursley.
Not to interrupt you, but I agree with you. I think that Dudley Dursley did learn from his mistakes. And I love the bit with the teacup. Harry's first instinct is to think that Dudley has sabotaged him. And only later comes to realize that this was a peace offering.
Dudley has realized the error of his ways, and while he doesn't have a way of truly expressing it, because look at his parents, he expresses it in the best way that he can by telling Harry that he doesn't think that he's a waste of space. I got out of it that he was glad to have known him.
And I think he finally figured out that Harry might be the reason why they have continued access to that world, but his mother and aunt were in the world first.
Dudley's not exactly the sharpest crayon in the box.
It's more like he's the nub.
In his own way, he does come to love Harry Potter and express it in the only ways he can.
The fact that Harry made arrangements for them shows the higher quality of person that Harry Potter is in comparison to Vernon Dursley. If the roles were reversed, Vernon would have taken his family and gotten out of there and left Harry sitting there without a word. But in spite of the torture that they put Harry Potter through, he still had the high moral character to look out for them and make sure that they were going to be safe before everything hit the fan.
Harry Potter is certainly an unwanted guest in Vernon Dursley's house. However, Petunia and Dudley are his only living relatives.
And what do you say to someone after 16 solid years of dislike? That's a near quote, by the way.
You say, "Here's Voldemort's address. Go say hi for me."
Again, showing the difference in people. Vernon applying his own morals and judgments onto Harry, fully expected Harry to be pulling a fast one, that he was trying to steal the house or whatever the other theories were that he came up with.
These are the worst sort of muggles.
Exactly. And the fact that Harry was able to become the good person that he was, in spite of the fact that these were the only people for 11 years that he had been exposed to, definitely provides an argument against the nurture argument of upbringing.
They made it clear in The Philosopher's Stone that the only reason that Harry Potter could get the stone is because he didn't really want it. Dumbledore said the same thing about the Resurrection Stone. It should really only go to somebody who isn't looking for it. And that's just it. Harry Potter is not looking to get something from the Dursleys. Harry has something to give them, protection. We talked about the Dursleys. Let's talk about the Dumbledores. Does this book change your opinion of Albus Dumbledore?
No, he's still dead.
That's a fact. That's not an opinion.
Well, granted, but no, I mean, my overall opinion of him did not change. Too many people were comparing him to Gandalf the White early on, and they got this idea in their head that he was supposed to be this grand, high, perfect being. And I don't think we were ever supposed to think that. We were supposed to see that he was a very skilled, very talented, very wise wizard with very human foibles. And that's what I saw before I read Deathly Hallows, and that's what I saw as I read Deathly Hallows.
I think those foibles were brought much more to the forefront in Deathly Hallows.
It's because Harry could finally see them.
Well, it started as early as Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. In the Goblet of Fire, it's the first time he turns to Dumbledore for questions, and Dumbledore doesn't have the answers.
Yeah, it's a big mistake in Goblet of Fire is that he should have said, "No, we said no one under 17. That means no one under 17. Harry is not competing."
Would you say that Albus Dumbledore saw Harry more as a son or more as a tool to use against Voldemort?
I think it's almost impossible to separate the two. Being the one person who knew the entire prophecy, he understood at the point that Lily was killed and that Voldemort tried to kill Harry, that at that point Harry became the chosen one, that it had to be Harry to kill Voldemort.
But more so, Harry was a Horcrux. Dumbledore knew from the time that he discerned that Harry was a Horcrux, he knew that Harry Potter had to die.
Yeah, and he also may or may not have foreseen what actually happened in the book with the blood mix thing.
What Dumbledore was trying to do, at least in this book, is make sure that at the end, Harry Potter had all three Deathly Hallows so he could escape death.
He knew Harry had to fight Voldemort. He never treated Harry solely as a tool. He definitely cared about Harry as a son or what have you, but he could never escape the fact that as long as Voldemort was out there, there was very little Harry could do to avoid fighting him.
In a lot of ways, it reminds me of the story of Jacob and Isaac.
Oh, there's biblical allegories all over these books.
But in this particular case, the fact that Dumbledore loved Harry and Jacob loved Isaac did not negate the fact that they knew what had to be done, and they weren't happy about it, and they were both praying for a miracle.
And they both got it. Well, let's talk about villains in the story. We've got Lord Voldemort, but how about Dolores Umbridge? Who's the bigger villain?
Going back to what I just said about biblical analogies, Voldemort is the Satan analogy. He is evil. Big capital letter E, evil. We know he's bad. He has his point of view, and he will do whatever it takes, and he feels perfectly justified in killing people to save his own soul, and pure blood should rule, etc. But he's very upfront and obvious about it. Dolores Umbridge is a public official working for what she honestly believes is the common good, and sees no problem with setting a Dementor on a 14-year-old boy.
And torturing people.
Yeah. I mean, Voldemort is immorality incarnate. Dolores Umbridge is slipping into immorality for what you think are good reasons.
Voldemort is a being whose soul has been split into 7 different vessels. He has no morals. Umbridge is doing acts of evil with her soul intact.
At least up to the point of the book where we don't see her anymore. We don't know what happens next, but...
Her Patronus was gone, and she was in a room full of Dementors.
Let's let our imaginations run wild for a second.
Yay! As long as we're talking about villains, Harry Potter gave Voldemort the chance to change.
This could even go back to the point of talking about people being redeemed. Harry legitimately gave Voldemort a chance to redeem himself.
Harry, in the end, didn't even try to kill Voldemort. Expelliarmus.
All he was doing was disarming him. Voldemort killed himself.
Voldemort says it in Chapter 1 of Deathly Hallows. He says, it's not so much that Harry Potter has defeated him, that Voldemort himself has made mistakes. Voldemort's first mistake was going after Harry Potter. If he had not tried to fulfill the prophecy that day, there wouldn't have been a 7th Horcrux. The prophecy said that the one who would come after him would be one of his choosing.
Okay, just out of curiosity, besides the general sense of, yeah, Voldemort is out there and he's trying to come back, who was the bad guy in Prisoner of Azkaban?
It was a red herring.
Unless you want to count Peter Pettigrew, there was no bad guy in that book on a functional level.
No, I think Peter was supposed to be the bad guy. Because everything that Sirius had been accused of, Peter was responsible for.
Here's a really important question I can't believe I forgot to touch upon. Was Peter Pettigrew redeemed?
Barely. Just barely. And that had more to do with the fact that he felt like he owed Harry a life debt.
I think he was redeemed in the eyes of Voldemort, which is why his hand killed him. Is he redeemed in the eyes of Harry Potter and the readers?
I think Harry Potter felt sorry for him because of the fact that in doing the right thing, it cost him his life.
Yeah, but how much of that was really redemption and how much of it was just repaying a debt? Although I will say I was impressed that Rowling set things up in the first book with Scabbers couldn't be turned yellow or anything because it was an animagus. They don't tell us that then, but you know, when you read book 3 and you realize, wait, it really all does build.
Even up through the Deathly Hallows, she's making reference to things that happened back in the first book and just now explaining it. You know she had to have set this stuff up at that point in order for it to get revealed here.
I think that there's a handful of items in Philosopher's Stone which were set up to be completed in Deathly Hallows. And there are other things that just came about and she's like, oh, I need something, like Luna Lovegood.
Luna Lovegood was clearly an afterthought.
And nevertheless, she became integrated into the story.
Yes, I personally would have preferred it if she could have been at least mentioned in passing in one of the earlier books.
I don't believe, until she wrote Order of the Phoenix, that she ever considered the need for this character.
That goes back to the character was an afterthought in the overall scheme of things.
I do wonder if the Philosopher's Stone itself was specifically set up to be a bookend with the Resurrection Stone, or if that was just an afterthought also.
Because of the similarities that the two have.
That is exactly my point. The Philosopher's Stone keeps you from dying, the Resurrection Stone brings you back. We all agree we like the story. Was there anything in the book that you think dragged?
When this goes to movie, I can easily see them cutting out large chunks of their camping out and merging locations together so that they don't have to be bouncing around as much, just to simplify things. I understand why they would need to move around, why they would need to change locations every couple of days. That makes perfect sense to me. But they seem to spend a lot of time just sitting around trying to think.
In order to follow the format of the previous books, we need to start at the beginning of the school year and end at the end of the school year. and have them moving from location to location to location, having them spend weeks out in the field, we're showing the passage of time.
And I'll say, I did find that a little tedious, and I think it was deliberate on Rowling's part to try to get across that Harry himself found it tedious.
What you said about the movies is a good point. There are a significant number of differences between the books and the movies. Is this a major issue?
Because of the things that they chose to cut out of earlier movies, when they resurface in this movie, I think it's going to prove to be difficult for whoever the filmmaker is.
Let's not beat around the bush. You were talking about the R.A.B. locket. In Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, Harry Potter finds the locket that we will later find out has been stolen by Regulus Black.
They spend a couple of pages talking about this particular locket, how nobody can open it. It's strange, it's unusual, let's just get rid of it, because it's obviously cursed. This was a scene that, reasonably so, was cut out of the movie because
it's not important to the Order of the Phoenix story.
Now, however, we see the great importance there was in that particular scene. And for people who are only watching the movies and not reading the books, how are you going to explain that scene?
They're either going to have to completely ignore it or show it in a flashback.
What's to stop them from saying, wait, when we were cleaning things out 2 years ago, and just stating it matter-of-factly? Which goes back to the actual question, which is, what is the function of the movie? Is the movie supposed to be a perfect replica of the story in the book, or is the movie supposed to be its own art form telling essentially the same story?
I believe it's the latter.
It has to be the latter. Otherwise, the only movie that essentially is any good is the first one.
And even that one has little bits and pieces removed from it. And actually, this brings me back to one of my pet peeves, when people believe that it has to be an exact replica of the book. That was one of the big complaints that people had about the Lord of the Rings movies. People were expecting the book put on film rather than a film representation of the book.
It's really impossible to tell a book as a film. You cannot literally translate it. There are places in a book where you will read 3 chapters that happen in 30 seconds. There are other places in the book where you're going to read 3 pages, which may take you an hour on screen.
One of the things that was actually missing from The Order of the Phoenix that I actually missed was at the very end of the book, when Dumbledore explains to Harry why he has to continually be going back to the Dursleys. That, to me, was one of the key points to that story, because by the 5th year, I know that I was sitting there wondering, why on earth does this boy have to continually go back and be tortured?
We know for a fact the Weasleys would take him in easily.
Why does he have to keep on going back and get figuratively, and in some cases, literally, tortured by the Dursleys? And the explanation that Dumbledore gives puts everything into light.
And you only have that question because you've been reading the books. I'll be honest, I don't think I know anyone who has just seen the movies. I could be mistaken, but to the best of my knowledge, anyone that I know who is into the Potter phenomenon has been reading the books and seeing the films both. You go to see a movie, and if you are just seeing the movie, odds are you're ducking the whole phenomenon, which means you're not thinking about it extensively between movies. You're going, you're getting your 2.5 hours of entertainment, and going back to your regular life, and that's it. You're not thinking about it as an ongoing thing. For those of us who go home, and there are the books on our bookshelves, at the point that you start thinking on that, you have the time to start wondering those questions. If you're thinking about it long enough to have those questions, you'll crack open the book.
Considering the fact that we spend 4 of the 5 movies starting out with him with the Dursleys, and we're seeing on film the rotten situation that he's in, I think that I would still have that question, even if I was only paying attention to the movies.
The average moviegoer, if they just see the movies, they're just going to see that as formula. Nobody ever stops to ask, why does James Bond avoid long-term relationships?
People just want to know who's the next Bond girl.
Exactly. It is just the formula.
I think ultimately, when you break it down and look at it as a story, the fact that he needs to go back to the Dursleys every year is not a function of the story Order of the Phoenix.
Again, back to the beginning of this question, it is something that plays a heavy role in the Deathly Hallows. So they're going to have to go back and explain why he had to keep on doing this.
And you'll get the 30-second version because it is only giving the viewer as much information as they need in the then and now of watching the film. if you're just watching the films, you're not interested in the minutia. You're interested in the minutia, you open the book.
I agree with Jim's point in general, if not in specific. I think there are things in the books that are missing that are important. I think there are things in the books that are missing and are changed that are unimportant. If you're a purist and you want to see the book put on screen exactly,
then you want to talk to the people at Warner Brothers about Harry Potter, the television series. 7 seasons straight up.
I'd like to discuss 2 more subjects before we call it quits for the day. First is, do you think that at this point we really need to see an origin of the Hogwarts story?
I don't think it's needed. If she somehow finds herself in need of several more $1 billion, sure, why not? Go on ahead and write 4 more books, The Origins of Hogwarts.
Jim, the title is Hogwarts A History.
The Hogwarts A History is not needed to tell the story of Harry Potter. I think we'd all come to agreement on that. However, in these 7 books, she has raised enough questions about the founders and the founding of Hogwarts that I think there's a legitimate series out there to be told that's not just a money-grubbing subject. I think we can legitimately find out, how did Godric Gryffindor get his sword? Why did 3 of the preeminent wizards of their time choose to start a school with the preeminent dark wizard of the time?
But the key to this question is it needed? If, for some reason, Rowling had decided, you know what, I changed my mind, I don't want to write book 7, there would have been wailing and gnashing of teeth.
I think you're arguing semantics now. None of the Harry Potter books were needed. There was absolutely no need to sell anything. Harry Potter as a 7-volume set is a complete story. If you want to answer more of the questions that these books raised, then I think you need 4 more books or 7 more books, or however many, to tell Hogwarts A History.
Is there a story there that could be told? Yes. I don't know that those questions are so burning that I would say that it is needed. The questions are there, but I can't...
But it's not going to drive you absolutely insane not knowing the answers.
Right.
Not having read the 7th Harry Potter book wouldn't drive anyone insane either. We all know the prophecy. Harry Potter's going to kill Voldemort. Do we know it's because he used the Expelliarmus curse? No. Is it necessary? No.
Tell that to the millions of people who were standing in line to pick up their books at 12:01 on July 21st.
If book 7 had not been written, Harry Potter's story would be incomplete. How Hogwarts came into existence beyond the basics that were given to us in the story itself is not germane to Harry Potter's story.
I would agree with that.
I guess for me, it comes back to the fact that I would like to see her do something else so that she can prove that she doesn't have to continually come back to this well. And to write Hogwarts The History would be coming back to that well again.
I don't see why there's any reason she can't write something else and write A History of Hogwarts.
Actually, she said she's considering writing an encyclopedia with a lot of the backstory that didn't make it into the books and writing it for charity.
I've heard the encyclopedia, I've heard a possible book 8 written specifically for charity. And you know what? If she does that, more power to her. I think that that would be a fantastic thing for her to do. And in a case like that, please come back to the well. That's for a good purpose.
And I think you're being a politician. Anything you're saying, it's okay for her to do it as long as she doesn't make any money off of it.
I'm saying that it's okay for her to do it as long as there's a good reason to do it.
I think storytelling for the sake of storytelling is a good reason.
Ultimately, I agree with that statement. I still say I don't think that the history of Hogwarts is essential to understanding the books that we have, which is about as close to an answer to the question as asked.
So the final thought before we conclude is, was anything left out of the epilogue?
There were little bits and pieces of information that I would have liked for her to have included. Things like, what are Harry, Ron, and Hermione doing for a living? Did Harry become an Auror?
Are there any dark wizards left for theirs to still be Aurors?
What happened to Luna Lovegood?
Did Professor McGonagall take over as the headmistress of Hogwarts? All of these were questions that clicked into my head as I was reading it, and they were all questions that I would have liked to have gotten answered, but I don't feel as though she has to write a book 8 to tell me these things.
There are unanswered questions, but to make it clear that life has gone on and they have moved into a relatively normal life, or whatever that means in a wizarding world, that they have moved to that point, and beyond that, the specifics aren't particularly germane.
I think there was plenty that was left out of the epilogue. Is it germane to the story? No, not really.
We just want to know.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Inquiring Minds were the Quibbler, Jim.
Well, that's a perfect example. What happened to Zeno? What happened to Azkaban?
We read the books, we get hung up on the minutiae. I'm including myself in there.
I don't understand why Hermione is not teaching.
If I could have changed one thing, I probably would have had Harry boarding the train with his sons to go and take up the school year as the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher.
I wonder if that position is still cursed.
After his kids are grown and on their own, they could always have him decide that he really wants to teach at his old university, and they could have, you know, a series called Welcome Back, Potter.
Welcome back. Actually, the one thing I'd change, and this is basically,
you know, and he could be teaching the Hogwarts. Ooh, Mr. Potter, Mr. Potter.
As far as one thing to change, and this goes back to the suggestion you mentioned off mic about a possible fanfic, what would have been an interesting touch is if they'd bumped into Dudley, who was letting his son board.
Because it is in the genetic pool.
Right, giving us some inkling of, yes, the Dursleys did in fact survive, that the defenses they set up worked, and to see that the magic is in the gene pool, it went to Dudley's son, and Dudley is coming to terms with it.
Continuing his growth as a character.
Any final thoughts on the series?
Yay! I like ye.
I really enjoyed it. I had a good time with it. There were things that I saw coming 8 years ago. There were things that I was completely suckered on. The whole bat boy thing of Petunias, and we finally figure out in book 7 that no, it was Servius and not James.
I'm really looking forward to seeing the epilogue on celluloid.
Celluloid is what they actually used to put films on.
That brings me to my final thoughts on it. And if I had nothing nice to say about this series at all, I would still thank J.K. Rowling for writing it because people are reading again.
Yes, that's a very good point.
I can ask a 10-year-old if they've read Harry Potter 7, and I can ask a 90-year-old if they've read Harry Potter 7, and get answers from both of them on how much they enjoyed it.
When I sat down to start reading on the 21st, as I was cracking open the book, I had this overwhelming sense of joy, because I knew that I was about to sit down and join millions of people in the exact same activity. People around the globe were united in doing one thing. We're not talking just in the United States even, we're talking globally.
I remember when I was actually about 11, in fact, my parents working very hard to try to get me to read, to appreciate reading. And while it did ultimately work, it was begrudging. It was something they were making me do. It was only after they actually stopped making me do it that I actually started reading for myself and I could start to appreciate it. And that J.K. Rowling has given billions of children around the world that incentive.
I've made no secret about the fact that I'm a librarian, and I've had a love for books my entire life. It's one of the great gifts that my parents gave me. And to know that, thanks to these novels, there are multiple generations that are getting that love for reading.
Any series of books that makes them reevaluate how the bestseller list works just to exclude them.
Because they know it's going to knock everything else off the chart.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us in Pottercast, Twerpcast Episode 4.
Some things that Twerps has coming up on the docket include our participation in the E-Day chats on August 5th. The chat that we're going to be featured in is going to be from 1:30 to 3 Central Standard Time on Trek United. That's www.trekunited.com. Sign up a little bit early, get a log-on account. They are free, so there's no charge to participate, but log in early and join us for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. Eras just finished releasing our third act of To Eras Human, and we have now started working on Act 1 of our third episode, which is entitled Yours, Mines, and Ours. So look for that to be coming out sometime in the very near future. We also have another production that is underway, which is going to be produced by our good friend Ken.
Jim is referring to I'm On 4. We are in production for the pilot. If it goes over well, it may turn into a series. It's four-color superheroes in a somewhat old-school tradition. It was written by a friend of mine in North Carolina named James Taylor. He didn't even know I was involved with Twerpcast or anything. He just showed it to a bunch of his friends online. I'm like, ooh, this is good. Wait, I'm doing these radio play things with the other. James, I've got this idea. Would you be opposed if we... And it kind of went from there. As I said, we're in production now. Hopefully we'll be finishing the casting soon, and once that's done, we'll probably be ready to start recording, so pilot will probably be released...
Probably November or December. As Ken pointed out, the casting is almost complete. We still have one or two, I think maybe three roles still available. So if you're desperately interested, please feel free to drop us an email. Let us know that you're interested. You can find out all the information through our casting page at www.torponline.net. In addition to that, we will give you a little sneak peek into the fact that we do have two other series that are currently in pre-production. So, Timewell Electronic Recording Productions is growing.
Your comments and feedback are not only welcome but encouraged. Please write Jim at torponline.net.
You have been listening to a Timewell Electronic Recording Production, copyright 2007. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Expelliarmus.